New Vancast to start the week. Jay Pat and Drancer here. And Drancer, we got a little Canuck news coming out of the weekend, and you were busy. I saw that you wrote about Vasily Podkolzin. The deal is done. The three-year entry-level contracts. We actually have some Canuck news to dive into. I thought we may end up digesting what Jim Benning had said to Donnie and Dolly on their show on Friday, and we can get around to that. But the news of the weekend certainly is that Vasily Podkolzin is in the fold.
It's a big ad for the Canucks, right? I mean, this is a guy who I think is going to play. I think you can, you know, write him in to the top nine, and I think you're safe to put that in Sharpie. Like, don't worry about the pencil. Don't worry about the number two. Just put it in ink. He's going to play top nine for the Canucks, and now it's just about figuring out exactly where, how that looks like, how they control, you know, his matchups, how sheltered he is. We've seen Travis go with prescribed usage. Four young guys as they slowly acclimate to the NHL level. And make no mistake, Vasily Podkolzin's going to have a bit of an adjustment here. But with his overall two-way intelligence, with the area game that he's going to be able to play day one in the NHL, you know, he's going to play for the Canucks. And yes, that's a reflection of their depth too. But man, do they need a $925K against the cap, you know, a top nine player. They have one done, one bit of off-season shopping executed before the off-season really even begins.
Yeah, well, let's just dive in sort of to the nerdy stuff, because it was included in the piece that you have written. It's up at The Athletic now, but entry-level contract, 3 years, as we know. You sort of get into the bonus structure and also the fact that there is no Euro-out clause for Podkolzin here. He is coming and he is staying.
He is coming, he is staying. There's no, like, Nikita Triamkin had one, right, and was able to refuse assignment to Utica. Elias Pettersson had one, did not matter. It's not going to matter for Vasily Podkolzin either, to be totally honest with you. Like, this guy's going to play at the NHL level. But, yeah, he's able contractually to be assigned to Abbotsford. I think that speaks to how motivated he was to come over, right? The fact is that this is... If you're a KHL player, KHL developed player, and you want to come over, like, you know, there's some slings and arrows. There's some challenges that come to that. Like, you have to be really committed to wanting to begin your North American professional hockey career. Podkolzin has been over 2 years. You know, honestly, a tremendous accomplishment to even get to this point for him. Speaks really well of, you know, his motivation, his desire to try his hand at the NHL level. And so does the fact that he's not got a European out clause here, right? Like, this is a guy who's coming to North America, no thoughts of staying in Russia, wants to be part of this organization and will be part of this organization. I ultimately don't think the European out clause is going to matter one way or the other. He's going to be in the lineup for the Canucks. But yeah, I mean, he'll be able to be reassigned should it come to that.
Do we know why? Like, it seemed... And this is not a big deal because they were going to get it done, but a little bit of odd timing in that the announcement came out on a sleepy Sunday morning where the general manager had said all along, and I think we were all conditioned to believe that this was going to get done at the conclusion of the World Hockey Championships. Why now?
Yeah, I don't understand the timing exactly, but, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, whether you keep it a deal in a drawer for an extra week or whether you do it, you know, once Jim had said it's done, basically, right? And once Dolly Wall had reported it's done, I mean, what's the benefit of not announcing it, right? Sure. There's none. So, you know, it is what it is. I don't read too much into it. Perhaps they accelerated the timeline because of what happened on Friday, because of what Dolly Wall's report on Saturday. But one way or the other, you know, not a huge deal. Certainly not something that's going to shape things, you know, in terms of the timing. The timing... you know what? Sorry. There is a reason, now that I think about it. There is a June 1st deadline on executing these deals with Russian players for the subsequent season based on the transfer agreement, I believe. And, so actually there is a reason that it got announced on Sunday, or before June 1st anyway, You need to file it with CR and get it all done and, you know, hickety-boo. Before the 1st of June. And then a similar sort of logic applies too to Carl Plaschik, who will be signed at some point, whether it's today or tomorrow or Wednesday, early this week anyway. You know, multiple sources confirmed that to The Athletic. We reported that in our piece on Monday. Not as, you know, not as needle moving a signing as Vasily Podkolzin, I don't think. But, you know, in Plashek's case, the transfer agreement deadline, I believe, expires on the 15th of June. So a little more flexibility in terms of when exactly that deal is formally executed and announced.
I saw somewhere on Twitter, a Russian reporter had a couple of quotes from Podkolzin about signing and talked about how, you know, he's working hard on his English, which I think is great. I think that, you know, it's great for him because it's going to make life that much easier for him. But I also think it speaks to, you know, a guy that clearly wants to be here and wants to fit in right away. And, you know, when you look at the way that Travis Green has handled his young players, like we hear the, you know, play the kids, and down the stretch, maybe Travis Green didn't play some of the guys that fall under that umbrella. But when you look at Travis Green's track record, starting Elias Pettersson at center ice, giving Quinn Hughes the keys to PP1 after a month in the National Hockey League, playing Hoglander the way that he did from day one of training camp, and now you've got a guy whose engine is always running.
And he was late on Hughes.
Yeah, I suppose you go back to the two games that he made Brock Besser watch right from the start as well.
Right.
But the guys that Travis Green clearly buys into and trusts, you know, he gives these guys every opportunity. And I see Podkolzin falling into that category too.
Oh, 100%. 100%. And, you know, what's going to be interesting is to see exactly how Podkolzin's game translates, because this is not a guy. Your average prospect comes into the NHL, and this includes Nils Höglander, even though his two-way game's relatively better developed because of the way that he wins battles along the wall and how good he is in transition, right? But the majority of guys, young players, Pettersson and Hughes, who come into the NHL, the part of their game that's really developed, that's ready NHL-wise, in NHL terms, is their offensive game, right? Like, that's the part of the game that they're ready to contribute to right away. What takes a little longer, typically speaking, and for Pettersson, it took a season and then there was some regression. Hughes was pretty advanced off the bat, but had some regression in his sophomore year, is that two-way impact. Like, what you're very unlikely to see at the NHL level, aside from extraordinarily special cases, is guys who come in at 21, as Podkolzin will, and immediately provide, you know, high-end two-way value, right? That's what's rare. Podkolzin's not probably going to be like a difference maker as a two-way piece in year one, because there's just too many details about the NHL game to learn. But he's got the hockey sense, he's got the physical size, he's got the area game, and he's got just that overall hockey intelligence that, you know, it's going to come a little bit quicker for him than average. And ultimately, I think that's where he's going to provide real value to this team at the NHL level, probably on his entry-level deal. But it is going to take some time, I think, for him to find a groove, right? Like, he's not a dynamic finisher. He doesn't profile to be an offensive superstar, right? Like, he's a supporting offensive piece who should be capable of playing top six ultimately. But really, what I think the club can count on for next year is that this guy's going to be capable of holding down, you know, a bottom six role and sort of figuring out the game pretty quick.
Right. And when I look at, you know, a guy like Nils Höglander, you know, so much of the advanced billing with Höglander was the YouTube stuff. It was the lacrosse goals. It was the between the legs. It was all the flashy stuff. And I think where, you know, he blew us all away was just this work rate from day one of training camp. And Podkolzin's already got that in his DNA. And I think Höglander showed, like, at the end of the season, Höglander's numbers didn't blow anybody away, right? Like, he wasn't Kaprizov, ultimately, although for a month there, people had him, you know, in the running for Rookie of the Year. And his numbers were fine for a 20-year-old, you know, making a splash.
He's their second-leading scorer, 5-on-5.
Right. This is not to diminish Nils Höglander's offensive contributions in any way. It's just that I think the real takeaway was this guy didn't take a shift off, right? And no. I think some people thought if he didn't score the lacrosse goal in his first three games in the NHL, that was going to somehow be disappointing. Right, because that's what a lot of people knew about Nils Höglander. But Höglander showed what's possible if you show up and compete every single shift, you know, good things follow. And I kind of get that sense that, you know, just trying to frame what people should expect from Vasily Podkolzin, you're right. I mean, you know, I don't think that there's going to be these big, big offensive takeaway numbers in his rookie season, and maybe ever. But you expect a guy whose work rate is through the roof good and is going to win way more, you know, than his share of the battles for loose pucks along the end wall. Like, just a really nice complimentary piece, but one that still does have some upside. Like, there will be some offense for this guy.
Oh, yeah.
But I just want to see him get here. And, you know, if he can sort of do a lot of the things that Hoglander did in his rookie season. I know he was a 10th overall pick, and so, you know, maybe there are higher expectations just based on his draft stock, but I just love the fact that you're getting a guy, you know, that's one thing that a guy can always control. Like, you know, what have we always said for 7 years with Jake Virtanen? Like, just, you know, show up and play hard. Like, and that hasn't happened, obviously, and yet for Pod Colson, and I think that's one of the things that's totally under his control, and something that I fully expect is from day one at training camp, like, we're going to be blown away by just how hard this guy works and how many puck battles he ultimately wins.
For sure. And the playmaking, right? That's the other thing he's got. The hockey sense isn't just, you know, as a defensive player within the area game or off the cycle or the work rate or the back checking. It's going to be also, you know, that this kid can pass the puck. Like, this is going to be something that, you know, I think he can do at a middle six level in the NHL day one. So, no, I mean, look, this is a big development for the Canucks. And, you know, that 2019 draft class was in the news a little bit today, right? In general, right? Because Rick Dhaliwal reporting that the Canucks will not sign Ethan Kepin, a fourth-round pick from that class.
Yeah.
I'd like to get into that because I actually think there's something interesting there. But sure. But then also the club is going to sign Carl Plaschek. He becomes the fifth player that they're going to sign from that 2019 class, a group that, you know, also includes Hoglander, Pod Colson, Artur Sylovs, and Carson Fucked. And then they've got a couple of seventh rounders who are for sure, they're for sure going to get signed at some point in Aiden McDonough, who's become a really good prospect, like as a top five prospect for the club out of Northeastern, and Arvid Kosmar, who I think is a top 10 prospect for this organization at this point, too, obviously had a tremendous showing at the World Juniors and is looking like a guy who might have a real shot to play, you know, a bottom six center role for the club going forward. You know, that's a nice haul. Like, that's, if you end up with seven guys signed from that draft class, you know, two guys who I think you are feeling pretty comfortable may play top 6 minutes for you, you know, over the long term in Pod Colson and Hoglander. Another guy who's got a shot, you know, if they can maybe figure out a little bit of extra, like if they can add 2% to their first step, Aiden McDonough could be a top six prospect. And then you've got a bunch of guys like Fucked. If you get one hit, one really useful depth contributor out of Plaschek, Fucked, and Kosmar, I mean, then you're talking about a transformative class for a team that's in desperate need of depth, right? Like, desperate need. A pretty incredible haul, all told. And one that sort of, you know, at the same time that you have to take it as a huge positive for the organization, you know, also something that sort of makes you think, you know, why did they significantly revamp the amateur scouting staff in the months that followed that draft? Like, seems like it was working pretty well based on those results, right?
Yeah, and you know, you also go back and we saw it in the late stages of this COVID season when, you know, Gadjevich got his opportunity and Cole Lynn got called up. And like five guys out of that 2017 draft class have now played in the National Hockey League. Whether they remain in the NHL, that's very much to be seen and to be debated, but the fact that 2017 draft class obviously has turned out, you know, pretty good. I mean, led by Elias Pettersson, which leads us into, and you've mentioned it a couple of times, but let's just push it out there for people that haven't seen it yet. You and Harm have taken a look at the Canucks farm system and the prospect pool, and you've mentioned Carl Plaschek a couple of times. I like the fact that you tagged him as really the first guy who's going to be signed by this organization with an eye to playing in Abbotsford.
Yeah, he's the first ever Abbotsford, whatever they end up being called, draft
pilot, flyer, arrow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? That 17 class, too, I just want to focus on this. Regardless of what happens with Lind and Gadjevich, and I'm pretty low on their NHL chances, I think at this point you're feeling pretty confident that you're getting a backup goaltender, like at least a backup quality goaltender, a guy who maybe has upside to be a 1A, 1B guy in Michael DiPietro. Jack Rathbone, I think, is going to play a lot of NHL games. And Elias Pettersson. I mean, that's a hell of a class, regardless right. of what yeah. happens, yeah. you know, from Gunnarsson, Palmu, and Brassard. And I'd expect nothing at this point from any of those three. you know, and even the next year, right? Like, even if Wu's just organizational depth, you get Quinn Hughes at 7, not too shabby, and Tyler Madden becomes monetized, right? Like, you know, regardless of what happened with Madden, the fact is that he was a Hobie Baker contender that you monetized in a major trade, right? Like, that's a win from a Canucks perspective. I mean, maybe less of a win if Madden becomes, like, you know, the second coming of Anthony Cirelli, although I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, nonetheless, that's a win for you right there. And then this 19 class looking pretty good. So it's interesting. Sorry, we were talking about Plashek going to Abbotsford. Yeah, no, I believe that deal, when it's done, will not include a European out clause. And it's Plashek, like Hashik with a PL, by the way. Just let's get ahead of the pronunciation there, so that we don't have any, early Hoglander issues. Remember that? Remember when we struggled so hard with Hoglander? Oh, my goodness.
Hoglander.
We got it eventually. But yeah, I mean,
I do wonder about, and with all due respect to the city of Utica, the people of Utica, you know, I do wonder if this is something moving forward here, now that the Canucks farm team is in their backyard, if it's easier to sell to some of the Euro prospects that they don't need the Euro out, like, you know, they're looking on a map and they're trying to figure out where they're going to play and live for the next bunch of years. You know, the Canucks can say, like, 45 minutes down the highway, like, you're going to have all of the, you know, the use of our staff and our facilities and those types of things and medical attention if you need it. And, like, I wonder if it's way easier, you know, for a guy that's worried about getting homesick and am I just getting stuck in the middle of nowhere, you know, can you sell to these guys and their agents that, look, this is being done with an eye toward prospect development, because we're going to be way more hands-on now that we've got our farm team and now we're down the road.
Maybe. I think the proof in the pudding, though, is going to come from a player less hell-bent on beginning their North American professional career than Pod Colson, or a sixth-round pick than Plashek. You know, like, we'll see the next time they have a Triamkin-style guy who's, like, already a first-pair guy in the K. You know what I mean? Like, pulling down a million plus all the benefits you get from playing in the KHL. You know, if that guy is willing to sort of forego the European out, right? Or your, you know, fifth overall pick who then catches absolute fire is the best player in the SHL, or the best player that the SHL has seen in 20 years. Like, can you get that guy to forego? Like, that's where the proof will come, as opposed to Pod Colson. I think Pod Colson was just committed to starting his North American pro career at a very rare level, and something that I think, you know, is commendable to him and speaks well to, you know, his overall makeup and character as a player. Hey, can we transfer quick? I want to talk Kepin. I know this isn't a big story, but I just want to drop a note on it, because
yeah, by all means, jump in.
I'm fascinated by pandemic effects. Right, like, I'm fascinated by the impact that the pandemic's going to have on player evaluation across the board. Right, like, I talk about it all the time with this 2021 draft class being just a massive opportunity for a team that's able to seize it, a team that's able to properly weight, for example, you know, the contributions of 16-year-old players. You know, like, forget breaking down and trying to project a guy's 17-year-old season, which is hard enough to do as an NHL team. But now you're trying to do it with a 16-year-old player's data set, you know, out of major junior for the most part, or maybe 13 games of dub hockey in the bubble, whatever, right? Like, you're not getting a lot of data here. You're not using your full arsenal of, you know, eyeballs in terms of, you know, scouting reports or times viewed or, you know, their statistical profile. And Kepin's an interesting case for this. Not because he was draft eligible, but from a player development side, right? Like, this is a guy who, you know, got hurt in the 2019-20 season, only played 44 games. So since the Canucks had him at training camp, his very first Canucks training camp in October 2019, right? He plays 44 OHL games, and then the pandemic hits. He misses a dev camp. He misses a prospect camp. He misses a Canucks training camp, right? Like, the Canucks basically do not have a touch point with this player for a span of 19 months, from September 2019 until the spring of 2001, when he signs a PTO and joins the Utica Comets and plays 7 games. Now, the organization saw him for 7 games in Utica, and I think front and center in the determination not to sign him is the lack of foot speed. But, you know, that's a pretty quick judgment. Like, that's a snap judgment on a 20-year-old player who, you know, having not played hockey in 14 months, got thrust into a higher level at the AHL and played 7 games, right? Like, this is a fascinating case. And look, I'm not saying the Canucks are right or wrong. I'm not trying to make this into a story that it's not, you know, like leaving a mid-round pick unsigned, you know, that's a routine occurrence in the NHL. But what makes this one interesting is how it sort of commingles with the lack of opportunity to work with the player from the Canucks side, the lack of games this player played as a result of the pandemic. That's what sort of makes it interesting to me. Anyway, Kepin will re-enter the draft. Talking to some industry sources, they wouldn't be shocked if he gets redrafted or signed thereafter. So, you know, I don't think this is like the end for Kepin by any means. It'll be interesting to see sort of where he ends up, but just an interesting sort of note on, you know, a note to consider on how, you know, this weird moment we've all lived through is going to impact player development, drafting, player evaluations, and on down the list for years to come. And we're seeing it. This is a real life example right in our backyard just over the course of this weekend with the Canucks reportedly, per Rick Dhaliwal, deciding to walk away from Ethan Kepin, whose rights, you know, as an unsigned draft pick expire on June 1st.
I had to laugh. I mean, I read your piece with Harm about the farm system and the prospect pool that we mentioned earlier. And one of the first comments was, that's a short article.
Was it? Was it really a short article?
No, it wasn't. I think he was getting at the fact that there isn't a whole lot in the system.
Yeah, you're right.
But when you've got all of your grade A's playing in the NHL, that's the way it goes, right? Like, that's just, we've talked about this, like, a decade ago, it was tougher to make the NHL lineup for the Vancouver Canucks because they were a stacked team that had legitimate Stanley Cup aspirations and got within a game. It was tough to crack that lineup. For these last bunch of years, there has been opportunity for these NHL-ready guys. So I think it stands to reason that you know, you don't have a ton of your blue chip prospects in the, you know, in your farm system. They've bypassed Utica for the most part.
Yeah, they have. And you know, the other thing that I think you should take from that article, like that article could be retitled like why the Canucks cannot afford to trade their first round pick this year, right? Like, they need an elite prospect here. You need to get a Mason McTavish or a Kent Johnson or a Brant Clark, or like, you need that type of high octane prospect in this system. Otherwise things get barren really quick. You cannot trade that pick to get off of money. Like, there's no way. This club needs so much more. You can't afford another 2020 draft class, right? Like, you cannot afford another class where, you know, you're looking at those guys and it's like Yoni Yermo, like, nah, you know, Jackson Coons, like, like, none of those guys are top 10 prospects for us, you know, like, none of them. And we're not that high on a lot of the guys who are. That's a problem, right? Like, this team needs to have more than that. You know, you can't have Jet Wu be the best defender left in your system. Like, that's right back to where, you know, 2014, right? Like, that's right back to the end of the Gillis era. No? Like, at the end of the Gillis era, at least, you know, there was nothing. So, you know, you're right back there. You can't afford to have classes like that, you know, and this 2021 draft is a tremendous opportunity to restock, especially with how much, you know, doubt there is, you know, and again, I mean, you look at guys like an Ethan Del Mastro, right, who's an OHL defenseman. He's like 6'5", good skater. He was going to be like a third or fourth round pick, and then he plays 8 really good games for the U18 squad, the Canadian U18 squad. Now he's going to go in the 20s, maybe 30s, right? Like, that's how quickly things change in a draft class with this few games. There's a guy named Lockhart out of the OHL. Guy's going to be drafted in the fourth round. He was the second overall selection in his OHL priority draft. Played a regular shift as a 16-year-old. Like, who knows what he would have done in his draft-eligible season, right? Could he have been Seth Griffiths, this year's Seth Griffiths, right? He's going to be available in the fourth round. In a normal world, he might have been picked in the teens. Right? So just so hard to project, so much uncertainty coming out of this. It's impacting so many young players. you know, at all levels, right? Like, I'm sure there's some people listening whose kids play minor hockey too, right? Who've been worried all year about what this means for their development. And that's true too, like at the highest levels of hockey, including for guys like Ethan Kepin, who the Canucks have decided not to sign, including, you know, even for guys like Nils Höglander, who had this weird rookie season where they played half the year in the SHL and half the year in the NHL. And, you know, did they fade a little bit down the stretch because of that? Like, you know, obviously the numbers don't suggest it, but I certainly think in terms of the, you know, qualitative defensive contributions that Höglander managed, you know, I'd say his last 36 games were not at the quality of his first 20, personally. That's my view anyway. And so, you know, it's just parceling that out, figuring that out is going to be such a task that hockey teams have to do, professional hockey teams have to do and do well. And there's a real competitive advantage to being the team that models it best here over the next 2-3 years.
Draft lottery goes on Wednesday, just to frame it. People probably know some of this, but again, as we count down now to the lottery balls dropping on Wednesday, 58.6% chance to stay in the ninth position for the Vancouver Canucks. So just a shade under 59% to remain ninth, 28% chance they could drop to 10th. There's like a really slim chance that it could actually drop to 11th, but that would require two teams behind them winning.
That would be very Canucks.
It would.
If any team is going to drop to 11th, J-Pat, it's
the Canucks. Yeah, sure. I know, we've been saying all along, oh, it's going to be at least a top 10 pick. Not necessarily.
We'll see.
There's a 2.4%.
Just like the Leafs are going to close out this series with no drama. Hey, the Canucks are going to get a top 10 pick. Like, it's the same thing.
As far as winning the lottery, and there are the two lotteries, remember, there's separate draws for first and second overall, 5.4% chance of winning the lottery, 5.7% chance of that second one. The great reveal comes up at 4 p.m. our time, Pacific time, on Wednesday, which will be done. It's sort of the lead-in, the preamble to game one of the Jets and whoever the Jets are going to face in the second round of the playoffs.
Yeah. Well, look, I think Toronto's going to win. I think Toronto's going to win because you forgot to mention Mitch Marner. And though he's been invisible all series, no, I don't know. I actually don't know.
Hang on. I want to talk about the Leafs and the Habs here in a sec.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So I want to talk Leafs and Habs because it's all the talk, obviously. One game, winner take all. Montreal wins in overtime the last two games to get this thing to a seventh game. We both picked Toronto at the outset. I think most of the hockey world picked Toronto to have a relatively easy time with the Montreal Canadiens. That's been anything but the case here. But I was thinking to myself, because yesterday, and there were two more games as the second round is underway, and we had the Lightning and the Hurricanes, and then the main event, the Avalanche and the Vegas Golden Knights. But as I was watching, you know, the national sports shows, you know, we couldn't get to those games until we had like 6 or 8 minutes of advanced billing for game 7 between the Leafs and the Habs. And that's just sort of the way it works in this country, right? We're all conditioned to that here on the West Coast. So I thought what we should do, Tom, is sort of turn the tables a little bit and deconstruct this game 7 tonight and look at it from a Vancouver perspective. Because people are calling this the biggest game in this country since 2011, since the Canucks were on their run to the Stanley Cup final. And, you know, I think it's important that we recognize the Canucks and Vancouver's contribution to this game tonight.
Yeah. Yeah. What does this mean for the Canucks? Let's turn the tables on the on our friends in the six.
Well, obviously, if Toffoli scores the winner or plays a prominent role, we're going to hear an awful lot. Like, you know, for all of the angst of Tyler Toffoli getting away from the Vancouver Canucks, if he rises up and plays hero tonight for the Montreal Canadiens, somehow people are going to think that that was a great move that he got away from the Canucks because he was put in this position to play the hero tonight. So certainly Tyler Toffoli is going to be a prominent
story. Sorry, has there ever been any doubt, though, that Tyler Toffoli was a great move for the Habs?
For the Habs, yeah. Yeah. Not so much for the Canucks.
People are going to say it justifies what the Canucks did? Come on. Come on. That's some serious small town vibes. We got to do better than that, Vancouver.
Alex Burrows and Manny Malhotra. You got former Canucks.
Well, and both managed the power play. Benches. Both managed the power play, and neither power play has been anything to write home about, right? So I think that's a good one. I like that one. That one's interesting. Can either of their special teams units, you know, play a decisive hand in this game? I think there should be some pressure on Malhotra. Like, I don't know that power play has been up to snuff. You know, clearly a very bright guy. I think he's going to be a head coach in the NHL, but the Leafs' power play needs to make a difference tonight. Their top players haven't come through. Their power play hasn't come through. They've had Joe Thornton on the first unit. It's driving me nuts, J-Pat. like I would be crushing that if the Canucks were doing something like that in a big playoff series. Like, I would be crushing that if we were covering it. So I think that's a good one. A lot of pressure on, you know, two veterans of the 2011 run. Going head to head in a special teams matchup in a crucial game 7 between ancient rivals. I like that one.
And I don't think it will compare to what Burrows did in the opening round in 2011,
no,
slaying the Dragon, but you know, like, this guy grew up in Montreal. He knows Leafs Habs and that rivalry and what it means to those cities and the country and everything else. Like, he was always a student of the game.
But I know Burrows was a Habs fan growing up, but with his personality, don't you feel like he was the kid in the hockey sweater who had the Maple Leafs jersey?
Lawrence Gilman.
Ooh, LG.
Hasn't seen a whole lot of playoff success since leaving Vancouver, right? Like, we know the track record of the Leafs.
Yep.
He's a guy that worked in Arizona for a while as well. Not a whole lot of playoff success happening there. Stakes are high. The stakes are high for, you know, everybody in the Leaf organization, but I would think upper management. And I don't know how well they slept last night.
Yeah, no, it's nerve-wracking. I mean, here's the thing though that I think we need to, and this will come back to my one Vancouver storyline that I want to bring up later, but one thing that has to be noted is, like, Matthews and Marner have combined for one goal in this series, J-Pat. One goal.
Yeah.
One goal. And they lost their second line center in game 1 to a, you know, catastrophic injury, right? And they're in game 7. You know, like, if you get one goal from your top players and survive 7 games in the playoffs, if you, you know, extend the lifespan that they've got enough time to find their game, that they're in a 7th game, a 7th time to figure it out, like, that's not on your roster's construction. You know, that's a well-constructed team if you can withstand getting bupkis from your top end throughout a playoff series and still be alive. When you look up and down this Leafs roster and you look at, you know, Brody's impact and Simmons's impact and how the Spezza Thornton gambles have worked out, the fact that Kerfoot's played well in this series, just the enviable depth that was built around this team, the fact that Jack Campbell's been so good, a starter at $1.6 million signed through next year. Like, I don't see how this should be a referendum on management. Clearly, this is a well-constructed team, and it's on their top players to come through at some point, right? It has to be. And that's sort of going to be the question they have to ask themselves if they lose. I think it would be a massive overreaction to treat this as an indictment of Kyle Dubas, who clearly armed, like, we talk a lot about arming your elite core with, like, the supporting cast they need, you know? Like, no one can look at this roster and say that the Maple Leafs have failed to do that. And for me, anyway, that would be a reason why I would, you know, I would consider any significant management changes coming out of this game in the event that the Maple Leafs lost to be a massive overreaction.
You mentioned Alex Kerfoot and, of course, Morgan Riley, a couple of Vancouver guys. There's another.
Yeah. Brendan Gallagher, baby, national hero. Never done the wrong thing once on the ice his whole career. It's incredible.
And Brett Kulak.
Oh,
another
Kulak.
Vancouver Giant.
Yeah, so there we go.
Two Vancouver Giants. You know, we could extend it and go like Carey Price and Shea Weber,
sure, as BC guys,
but this is really, we're trying to focus here on Vancouver's contributions to this game tonight. Frederik Andersen, who probably won't play, but he was selected with the draft pick the Canucks sent to Anaheim for Max LaPierre, right?
Like, yeah,
there
that's
is
true.
A Canuck connection.
Yeah. I like that one. Is there any other? TJ Brodie, former Abbotsford Heat player. There we go. Well, the Vancouver connections abound.
Of course, the Canucks should have drafted Willie Nylander.
Who's your Vancouver area? Oh, that's right. Who's your Vancouver area MVP for this game? Like, you pick one Vancouver player to be a big difference maker.
All right, and if you've got others, well, by all
means, pick your MVP and then go on. Come on.
Oh, okay. I'll go Gallagher. I'll pick Brendan Gallagher tonight.
I'm going to pick Kerfoot. I like Kerfoot. Okay. I think Kerfoot's good. I think Kerfoot is better than his reputation. I like that he can play at speed. I think he's going to have a big impact tonight. So
I think the Leafs are going to win.
Me too.
So I'll pick Brendan Gallagher to have an impact in the game. I still think the Leafs are going to win. My other connection to this one, though, is that Cole Caufield was drafted 15th overall in 2019.
Looking
where
good.
Was he drafted?
Five spots drafted? After Podkolzin and in Vancouver.
Yeah, but at Rogers Arena, yes. So there we go.
There's a lot of people being like, well, the Canucks should have picked Cole Caufield. And it's like that first round is looking loaded. You know, like yes. Loaded. Yeah. Like Zegras was drafted one pick ahead of Podkolzin, and he's incredible. Spencer Knight, like, holy cow, that kid's incredible. Alex Newhook, like the amount of talent that seems to have gone in that first round is ridiculous. And I'm seeing some people be like, well, the Canucks whiffed on Podkolzin. Like, he doesn't have the offensive top end of Caufield. And it's like, sure, but he's, you know, a 205-pound, 6'1" or 6'2", you know, behemoth who plays an excellent area game and is NHL-ready next season. Like, just because there's other prospects excelling from that draft class doesn't make Podkolzin a bad pick by any means. You know, what might be a bigger concern, I think, is when you look at the process and sort of understand that one of the reasons the Canucks were reluctant to trade back and had options to trade back, you know, I think it was the Arizona Coyotes who traded down traded up in that class, but it was Philly. Philly took the opportunity that was on the table for Vancouver as well. You know, I mean, maybe they could have done that. I think they were pretty high on Philip Broberg, so I guess you could sort of say that maybe there was some process errors there, but. You know, Podkolzin's a great prospect. There's no use wringing your hands about this one. This is not a pick that the Canucks got wrong. This is a tremendous prospect. It just so happens that first round is loaded with talent.
Yeah, and I mean, just to look at that top sort of 10 or 12, you know, Jack Hughes, Kaapo Kakko, Kirby Dach, Bowen Byram went fourth that year. Dylan Cousins playing in the National Hockey League already. You mentioned Zegras.
Byram might be the best player in the class. Like Byram or Zegras are probably the guys who, if you redraft, go 1-2.
Yeah, Spencer Knight 13th and Cole Caufield 15th. Newhook was 16th. So, yeah, I mean, the potential there, let's, you know, look back in a few years.
Also, people like, oh, they really should have drafted Cole Caufield. It's like, they got Hoglander. Hoglander the next round. Like, what are you talking about? They're probably going to come out of the first five picks or first 50 picks with two top six forwards and Canucks fans are spoiled about it. Come on. Ridiculous. I don't often have takes like this, but that one's ridiculous.
All right. So I think we've established that while Montreal and Toronto will do battle in this game, it's pretty clear that Vancouver is really the most important city.
Yes.
Heading into game seven.
Oh, yes. And hey, I've got the last thing, right, is if you're a Canucks fan looking for reasons to pump your chest out triumphantly, you know, in regards to the Maple Leafs, right? I think you've got a lot on the line from the Maple Leafs losing again in the first round, especially considering what Pettersson and Hughes and the Canucks' young core managed to achieve in the bubble last season, right? Like, fundamentally, if the Maple Leafs lose this series, it's going to be on Marner and Matthews, right? Like, it's going to be on the fact that their top end was invisible to this point. And we've seen Vancouver's young core elevate their games. Right? The roster construction, the fact that they've got this sort of clean lineup in terms of, you know, a 3 or 4 year runway to compete for the cup, like those are things that Toronto has accomplished that are aspirational for Canucks management, right? Like that hopefully if the Canucks do a bunch of things right over the next 3-4 years, they'll get to that stage. But in terms of how Vancouver's young core showed up in the playoffs last year versus, you know, the Maple Leafs being 0-6 in games with a chance to advance over the past, you know, over this core sort of runway, the fact that Mitch Marner hasn't scored a playoff goal in 16 games going into tonight, you know, those are all sort of big talking points that I think Vancouver fans can take heart in especially as they sort of compare their young core to Toronto's.
We told you this on our last episode, that the podcast options here at The Athletic, now that we're into the playoffs, but the offseason has begun for a number of teams, we've expanded our podcast offerings. So The Athletic Hockey Show now goes 5 days a week, Monday with Ian Mendez and Haley Salvian, Tuesday, Craig Custance and Sean Gentile. On Wednesday, it's the two-man advantage version with Scott Burnside and Pierre LeBrun. On Thursday, you've got Mendez with Down Goes Brown. And Friday now, and this is something that Canuck fans may want to be paying more and more attention to with the draft lottery on Wednesday, the Prospect Series with Max Boltman and Corey Pronman. So all of those are available at The Athletic if you're looking for other pod options. We also say check out our comment section for every podcast episode we record. And I just want to read a quick comment here that came in from the last episode. Somebody with the initials BJP. Thanks, fellas. Love making my wife listen to the VanCast while I drive us to the cabin for the weekend.
Nice.
Yes. I hope the wife has come around. I hope she's a VIP and a VanCast fan as well. So we thank you for that feedback. But we do look at the comments that people leave there. So check out our comment section for each podcast episode at the Athletic app. Rate and subscribe to the VanCast on Apple. And if you're not already a subscriber, go to theathletic.com/VanCast and receive a subscription for just $3.99 a month. Tom's got a deep dive on Pod Colson. Tom and Harm have looked at the farm system for the Vancouver Canucks. And I saw Harm also co-authoring a piece on, and it was fascinating, looking back at draft success team by team over like the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think it goes back to the lockout year of 2005.
So, and it's 10 years because it sort of ends at 2015. So some of Vancouver's recent draft successes, which we actually went over on this podcast, aren't factored in. The Canucks do not show well in this overall analysis. But, you know, a lot of some of what's come lately or more lately isn't considered. So, but a very interesting piece. And, you know, one thing that stands out to me, J-Pat, is like right at the very top, you see the Anaheim Ducks, right? And the Anaheim Ducks are not good. I think there's an argument to be made that they were the worst team in hockey this year, especially when you factor in, you know, the COVID outbreaks that teams like Buffalo and the New Jersey Devils went through, right? Like you go look at the bottom of the standings and it's like Anaheim, Columbus, and a bunch of teams that had massive COVID outbreaks, right? Like, that does not reflect well on the Ducks.
Right.
And yet, they're one of the best drafting teams the past, you know, certainly that 10-year window. And I think what that speaks to is something worth keeping in mind, which is the draft is a crucial avenue to improve, but it's not the end-all be-all. Like, you can draft great players and screw it up. Like, you can draft William Karlsson and Shea Theodore and their home run picks, but if they end up being the first line center and the first pair defenseman for your division rival because you mismanaged the expansion draft and traded William Karlsson for, you know, seven games of Wisniewski or whatever, it doesn't effing matter. And so, yeah, I mean, that's just a point that I wanted to bring up because, you know, the draft is important. The draft is crucial. And yet I do think it gets lionized to some extent at the expense of some of the other things that really matter in building a winning team. And I think that's a really good example and something that I took away and found fascinating within that piece.
Draft lottery on Wednesday. We're inside of 2 months from this year's draft. Of course, the schedule tilted because of COVID and the late start and everything else. So the draft slated for that third weekend of July. So the countdown very much on, and we'll know on Wednesday where teams are slotted and then things will heat up from there. For Drancer, it's J-Pat. As always, we thank you so much for your support, for hanging in there with us even here in the offseason. We continue to push out podcasts 3 times a week. So lots of Canucks content for you here at The Athletic and theathletic.com.